The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from KHUH LP 104.9 FM Seattle, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day, you turned on your radio, and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee! All right, welcome to the Thunderbolt for March 13th, 2020. The news and commentary section for this week's show originally aired on May 20th of 2016. Enjoy! This is a warning. The Thunderbolt is about to engage in indecent exposure. If you have small children in the car listening with you, make sure that they listen to this piece. Now that he is finally taking on exposing the Democrats, Seymour Hersh is trashing, thrashing, and thumping them to no end. Yippee! Seymour Hersh is one of the most effective journalistic bomb throwers in the business, and in true Hersh style, there are several truly explosive exposures in his latest exposés concerning war crimes, Obama's push into Syria, the killing of Osama bin Laden, and many other things as well. And in addition, conveniently timed to land like a turd on his doorstep, just after Obama's visit to kiss Saudi Arabia's butt, Mr. Hersh reveals that Saudi Arabia played a central role in the sarin gas attack on Syrian civilians a couple of years ago. And in further addition, Mr. Hersh also significantly adds to the existing canon of evidence that Osama bin Laden received substantial support from the highest levels of the Saudi Arabian machine both before and after 9/11. In further additional addition, Mr. Hersh, interestingly for the window that it reveals into how these people operate, reveals that the original plan was to transport Mr. bin Laden's body back into the Hindu Kush and then to claim that they had droned him there. But Mr. Obama got cold feet lest the story come out before they were ready. And in yet even more further addition to all of that, it was election season, and announcing the killing at the time that he did provided great political advantage to the Democratic Party. And so Obama jumped the gun, However, while this was a political feather in his cap, at the same time, it meant that they had to admit that Mr. bin Laden had been living more or less openly in Pakistan for many years. And I am speculating that avoid having to provide such an explanation was probably the very reason that they came up with the elaborate and risky Hindu Kush plan in the first place. Announcing that they had killed Osama bin Laden in downtown Abbottabad, right down the street from a Pakistani military base, led to many uncomfortable questions about our very good friend, Pakistan, and about how much they knew about the goings-on over at the bin Laden ranch. And speaking of elections, do you remember the rigged voting machines in the key states that are actually what determines who will be our next president these days? Do you remember that I predicted right here on your favorite radio program that absolutely nothing would be done about this, since the ability to rig elections is highly favored by both the Republican and the Democratic parties? Well, not only has absolutely nothing been done about the rigged voting machines, but you never even hear about them anymore. Ha! Mission accomplished! So Greg Palast and a couple of others are screaming about this, but they are screaming into an airless void. No one is paying attention.
The enemy is now in sight above the Palisades.
Many Democrats are screaming about Republican voter suppression techniques. But the recent primary in New York proves that these techniques are also bipartisan. Thousands of mostly young and black voters, i.e. Bernie Sanders voters, were systematically disenfranchised. And tellingly, Rachel Maddow completely ignored the fact that over 100,000 voters in New York were disenfranchised. She instead chose to lecture Bernie Sanders that it was time to quit fracturing the Democratic Party and that he should step aside and make way for Queen Hillary. I would expect nothing less from the head spokesperson for MSDNC. In addition, while Democracy Now! Did at least mention the mass disenfranchisement, they tellingly not only did not allude even to the possibility that this was a tactic used to rig an election, but they featured a local black politico who immediately dismissed such concerns and assured DN listeners that New York elections always sucked and that this was simply a case of incompetence rather than any kind of nefarious plot on the part of the Democratic Party machine. While Democracy Now! Regularly criticizes individual Democrats, when push comes to shove, they always seem to fall in line. Which is sad, I think. Now, the recent primary in New York is also important because this is the bellwether of things to come. Now that voters are onto their game, the machine is marginalizing the power of the voters in numerous and varied ways. And according to Greg Palast, this is just the opening salvo. I will now issue an official Thunderbolt prediction, and I will confidently state they will soon begin aggressively stepping up the suppression of dissent even more as well. Look out. For a long time now, I have been utterly baffled by Israel's undue influence over our own government. My research into this matter led to my discovery that for over 100 years now, one of the central tenets of the Zionist strategy for acquiring and then maintaining a Jewish homeland has been to hitch their wagon to some major world power, and then ride along with them, whilst occasionally trying to turn their own cart in the desired direction.
Fights between the blue you once knew. Floating down the sound, the sounds around the icy waters underground. Jupiter and Saturn.
Israel first allied with the Ottoman Turks. Then they switched to the German Kaiser. Then they went with the British before moving toward the French. And then they finally hooked up with the United States. The deal in all of these various alliances was that the Zionists would support whatever hegemon they were kissing ass up to at that time in return for their support of a Jewish homeland. So this strategy is actually quite understandable considering Jewish history. But the manner in which the Zionists have conducted their business
has now made them just as reprehensible as most of their oppressors ever were. So as mentioned, for many years now, I have been utterly baffled by the fact that the American government seems ever ready to support Israel, even though Israel has now become a brutal apartheid police state, and even though Israel regularly commits heinous war crimes. Both of the major American political parties unquestioningly and without query support Israel's interests, even when those interests seem counter to our own. Now, in order to answer any such question, one must always first answer this question. Qui bono? Who benefits? What does Israel have to offer to the United States in return for our government's unquestioned and massive financial and military support? Well, there are actually probably several reasons, but this week I would like to submit a theory that possibly you have not considered. I would propose that Israel has become an invaluable laboratory for tactics and strategies that are effective in domestically oppressing large numbers of people whilst yet maintaining the guise of a, quote, democratic government. Now, our world is full of brutal dictators. Most of these brutal dictatorships are also supported with your tax dollars. But that's yet another issue for yet another time. The point is that brutal dictators usually do exactly what you would expect brutal dictators to do. Israel, on the other hand, is accepted, at least by the American public, as a, quote, democracy. Now, maintaining this fiction is vital to Israeli security interests in order to keep that funding flowing from both the United States government and from American Zionists. Now, a related factor is that while the United States is the king of the roost when it comes to arms sales, Israel is also a major arms exporter. Military security is a $2.5 trillion per year industry.
Winding signs flap, flick a flick a flick a flap.
But this week, I want to focus upon a lesser known factor that is at play here. And that nations are not really fighting that many wars with each other these days. The United States is almost certainly never going to go to war with Russia or China, for instance. Pretty much all of the wars since World War II have consisted of Western powers either indirectly oppressing third world countries by financing and arming proxy civil wars from within, and or financing proxy armies from without. In this new era of indirect warfare, the goal is usually not occupation or even to gain territory. These are wars of policing and pacification. These mini wars are meant to keep common people under the heel of the designated local Western influence elites. Even when the Americans do overtly attack someone with their own military,
your fight's so epic, 'cause we all have a heart.
Their high-tech equipment. Their nuclear missiles. And their naval bombardments are next to useless against foes such as ISIS. And thus, policing has become much more popular, while overt militarism is actually on the wane. And this is why the police have become a lot more like soldiers. And that is why soldiers have become a lot more like the police. Soldiers are no longer necessarily there just to win battles. And the police are no longer there necessarily just to fight crime.
The plastic punch.
Now, the central role for both institutions has largely become oppressing poor people for the benefit of rich people. And you can see it everywhere, from Afghanistan to Ferguson. And I can guarantee you that the drones that you see today flying over Yemen will be flying over Olympia tomorrow. Now, the American prison industrial complex is also a part of all of this. When you have a proliferation of what Henry Kissinger referred to as, quote, useless mouths, i.e., people that provide no profit to the capitalists, then you can transform them into useful mouths by charging the government $50,000 a year to keep them in prison. Now, this state of affairs has developed because for over the last 100 years, the United States pioneered a new form of indirect imperialism. I.e., rather than occupying a country with a big expensive military force, the Americans simply bribe and or threaten and or coerce locals into doing their dirty work for them. Big massive militaries with their big massive infrastructures are mostly useless in this type of imperialism.
Now, this is more police state stuff rather than military occupation type stuff. And over the last 50 years, Israel has developed highly effective tactics of police state oppression, as well as surveillance systems and security systems and myriad other tools for oppressing civilians. And I would suggest that a lot of Israel's value to the Western powers consists of the fact that they are now exporting all of these tactics and tools of oppression all over the world. And I would suggest that many of these tools and tactics are being used by the Pentagon in places like Afghanistan. And I would further suggest that these tools and tactics of oppression are even being used right here in the United States.
Now, this idea that Israel is exporting oppression first came into my head when I learned that Israeli agents were teaching American police forces how to oppress and suppress us during the Occupy movement. American cops needed help from the Israelis on how to suppress dissent. Really? Indeed, one of many revelations that the Ferguson situation brought about was that there are Israeli security agents all over our country training American police forces on how to suppress dissent. It turns out that Israel is not only the world's leading expert on how to effectively suppress civilian populations, but they are also the pioneers in looking good whilst doing so. For you see, Israel is proving that not only can you be a brutal oppressor, but you can also be considered to be a, quote, good guy while you do it. Yeah, and now Israel has taken this worldwide. They are teaching nasty people all over the planet how to deal with their own Palestinians.
And I had to cut this piece in half to fit into my new time format, so part two of the Laboratory of Oppression will be back after a quick station break. The views expressed on this program are strictly those of the show's producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station nor anyone associated with this radio station. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. And now we continue with part two of the Laboratory of Oppression. For yes, kids, I have discovered that it is not just the Western hegemons that Israel serves. In spite of the fact that the whole Middle East thing is supposed to be a clash between Jews and Muslims, probably one of the closest partnerships in the entire planet right now is the one currently existing between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Which, other than the Muslim-Jew thing, makes perfect sense, since they are two of the most brutally oppressive countries on the planet. It makes even less sense, at least on its face, that in addition to assisting the Western powers in Saudi Arabia, there are also Israeli, quote, trainers all over Africa and South America teaching various dictatorships in those regions on how to oppress their people. Even the poorest and most destitute countries still have cadres of elites who usually represent a combination of political, commercial, and military interests. And Israel is there for you if you need help in protecting those interests. Yes, Israeli trainers are operating in many locales that may seem counterintuitive. Israel provided weapons and training to both sides, both before, during, and after the Rwandan genocide, for instance. Israel is currently arming various factions in Sudan. In Colombia, Israel has been arming and training both the Colombian government forces and the FARC forces for many years. Israel assists the Kurds in Syria and helps Turkey to oppress the Kurds in Turkey.
almost any elite factions anywhere in the world can generally call on Israel for help in oppressing their own people if they so wish. So, one may ask, why would Israel bother with helping corrupt third world governments? Well, here is a small but typical example of how Israeli involvement in the third world helps both their own interests and those of their benefactors in the first world. Since it is obvious to everyone that Israel has absolutely no interest in making peace with the Palestinians, and that they plan to just carry on with the, quote, peace talks indefinitely without ever resolving anything, then last year, the Palestinians brought a resolution to the UN that the General Assembly impose a timeline on Israel for these peace negotiations. They did this because they knew that if their resolution received enough votes to pass, then the United States would veto it, and, in a sense, that is exactly what the Palestinians wanted to happen. I am thinking that they wanted to demonstrate that it was actually American interests that were impeding peace in the Middle East. However, they needed 9 General Assembly votes to pass the resolution in order to force the American veto, and they thought they had enough. But it turned out that due to a surprise no vote from Nigeria, they did not have enough votes. Now, Nigeria is usually not only a rock-solid vote for Palestinian causes, but Nigeria could actually be considered a leader in Africa as far as supporting the Palestinian cause goes. Yet Nigeria surprised everyone by abstaining from this vote. And as a result of Nigeria's abstention, the resolution failed and the United States was not forced into the embarrassing position of, once again, very publicly thwarting peace in the Middle East. Now, why did Nigeria do this? Well, a Nigerian spokesman later explained that they had abstained because Israel was the only country in the world that was providing them with any significant aid in their battle against Boko Haram. So over the years, the Israelis have advanced the art of dehumanization into a science. Flesh by key, flesh by ya, get flesh by key. Even though Israel has one of the largest and best equipped armies in the whole world, whilst the Palestinians have nothing but rocks and a few crappy rockets that can't hit anything, Israel still manages to successfully portray itself as the victim in this situation. During their orgy of mass murder in Gaza a few years ago, Israel actually used white phosphorus weapons on civilians. Now, white phosphorus is one of the most heinous weapons it is possible to kill someone with, as once white phosphorus gets onto your skin, it burns to the bone, and there is absolutely nothing that can be done to stop it. Now, this was just one of a plethora of major war crimes committed by the Israelis, but as with the United States, Israel seems to be completely immune to prosecution for war crimes. In addition, Israel is busy exporting their highly effective methods for the brutal oppression of civilians all over the planet as a means of furthering their long-standing strategy of currying favor with various power brokers. Israeli agents are literally in the United States teaching American police how to treat us like the Israelis treat the Palestinians. So there is a popular slogan amongst Palestinian rights activists that we are all Palestinians. Now they mean this in a metaphorical sense, but it might also be considered to be true in almost a literal sense. And so, in conclusion, Israel has become one of the most toxic and malignant forces on the planet, other than the United States government itself. Yes, there are many countries that engage in tactics that are even more horrific than anything the United States or Israel practices, or at least anything that they do overtly. But for overall strategic nastiness, the U.S. and Israel are the team from hell. And I am convinced that they both need to be curbed if we ever want to live in peace on our planet. And let's be clear here. Achieving peace is not just an academic exercise or a pie-in-the-sky dream. Pretty soon, peace is no longer going to be an optional choice. It will soon be the only choice other than extinction. Warfare is already transforming from standing armies facing each other on smoking battlefields into a situation wherein the government engages in low-intensity battle upon their own people in their own cities. Armies are being replaced by militarized police forces. The, quote, enemy is being transformed from foreign soldiers into criminalized portions of our own urban poor. And dissent is being transformed into terrorism. Now, I have personally been engaging in very public and very in-your-face dissent for many years now. And this means that when they finally do start bringing in the cattle cars, I will most likely be near the front of the line. Naturally, that's fine with me. For if it ever does actually get to that point, I think that I would rather miss that party anyway. So I'm going to say what I'm going to say. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And frankly, I don't really give a flying fig. However, I would really rather that things did not get to that point. And so, It's time to get to work now, kids. Commentary section this week. It's time to get to work. So for you Seattle listeners, I have some music now. This is Utah Phillips. Enjoy.
I learned in Korea that I would never again in my life abdicate to somebody else my right and my ability to decide who the enemy is.
Please forgive me.
I was so mad at what I'd seen and done, I wasn't sure I could ever live in the country again. I got on the freight trains up in Everett, north of Seattle, and kind of cruised the country for 2 years, making up songs, but I was drunk most of the time and forgot most of those. I'd heard that there was a house in Salt Lake City by the Roper Yards of the Denver Rio Grande and Western where there was a clothing barrel and free food. So I got off the train there. I was headed for Salt Lake anyway. I found that house, but right where they said it was, most of all, I found this wiry old man, 69 years old, tougher nails, heart of gold, fellow by the name of Ammon Hennessy. Anybody know that name, Ammon Hennessy? One of Dorothy Day's people, the Catholic workers, during the 30s, they started houses of hospitality all over the country. There are about 80 of them now. Ammon Hennessy was one of those. He'd come west to start this house I'd found called the Joe Hill House of Hospitality. Ammon Hennessy was a Catholic anarchist, pacifist, draft dodger and two world wars, tax refuser, vegetarian, one-man revolution in America. I think that about covers it. It was pure hell. First thing he did was he said, after he got to know me, he said, "You know you love the country, that you love it. You come in and out of town on these trains singing songs about different places and beautiful people. You know you love the country, you just can't stand the government, get it straight." He quoted Mark Twain to me, "Loyalty to the country always, loyalty to the government when it deserves it. Get it straight, get it straight." It was an essential distinction I had been neglecting. And then he had to reach out and grapple with the violence, but he did that with all the people around him. His Second World War vets, you know, on medical disabilities and all drunked up. The house was filled with violence, which Ammon, as a pacifist, dealt with every moment, every day of his life. He said, "You've got to be a pacifist." I said, "Why?" He said, "It'll save your life." But my behavior was very violent then. I said, "What is it?" He said, "Well, I can't give you a book by Gandhi, you wouldn't understand it. I can't give you a list of rules that if you sign it, you're a pacifist." He said, "You look at it like booze. You know, alcoholism will kill somebody. Until they finally get the courage to sit in a circle of people like that and put their hand up in the air and say, 'Hi, my name's Utah, I'm an alcoholic.' And then you can begin to deal with the behavior, see? You can and have the people define it for you whose lives you've destroyed." He said it's the same with violence, you know. An alcoholic alcoholic, they could be dry for 20 years. They're never going to sit in that circle and put their hand up and say, well, I'm not alcoholic anymore. No, they're still going to put their hand up and say, hi, my name's Utah, I'm an alcoholic. So it's the same with violence. You got to be able to put your hand in the air and acknowledge your capacity for violence and then deal with the behavior and have the people whose lives you're best with define that behavior for you, you see. And it's not going to go away. You're going to be dealing with it every moment and every situation for the rest of your life. Well, I said, okay, I'll try that. And Ammon said, it's not enough. I said, oh. That you were born a white man in mid-20th century industrial America. You came into the world armed to the teeth with an arsenal of weapons. The weapons of privilege. Racial privilege, sexual privilege, economic privilege. You want to be a pacifist, it's not just giving up guns and knives and clubs and fists and angry words, but giving up the weapons of privilege and going into the world completely disarmed. Try that. That old man has been gone now 20 years, and I'm still at it. But I figure if there's a worthwhile struggle in my own life, that's probably the one. Think about it. I'd always wanted to write a song for that old man. He never wanted one about him that way, but something mulched up out of his thought, his anarchist thought. Anarchist in the best sense of the word. Oh, so many times he stood up in front of Federal District Judge Ritter, that old fart, and he'd be picked up for picketing illegally, and he never pled innocent or guilty, he pled anarchy. And Ritter'd say, what's an anarchist, Hennessy? And Ammon would say, why, an anarchist is anybody who doesn't need a cop to tell him what to do. Kind of a fundamentalist anarchist, huh? And Ritter'd say, but Ammon, you broke the law, what about that? And Ammon'd say, oh, Judge, your damn laws, the good people don't need them, and the bad people don't obey them, so what use are they? There for 8 years, and I watched him, mainly watched him, and I discovered watching him that anarchy is not a noun but an adjective. It describes the tension between moral autonomy and political authority, especially in the area of combinations, whether they're going to be voluntary or coercive. The most destructive, coercive combinations are arrived at through force. Like Ammon said, force is the weapon of the weak.
Strong enough.
Sing one for Frying Pan Jack, who's alive, and the oldest of the old out there in Albany, Oregon. Frying Pan Jack settled out off of the train, the great tramp. He got scared. He always told me if I get afraid to walk into a railroad yard, a makeup yard, it'll be time to quit. He used to carry a spike ball handle in his vindle, his bedroll, balloon, he called it, to fend off the ne'er-do-wells, but you know, the way it's gotten to be on the skids now, young, mean drunks and drug money. And so they prey off the old poor down under the railroad bridges. And so they tend to settle out and stay in one place where they feel safe. You see, he feels safe in this bar over in Albany, Oregon. If you want to find Frying Pan Jack, that's where you look for him. We shared a camp down there in Oroville at the foot of the Feather River Canyon coming out of Keddie on the Western Pacific. Keddie, up at the top of the canyon, still has a wooden water tower. It's never been torn down and you can camp under it. Anybody ever been there? Up in the High Sierra? Well, it's beautiful. Jack and I were in that camp. That's where he said to me, you know, he'd been tramping since 1927. He said, I told myself in 27, If I cannot dictate the conditions of my labor, I will henceforth cease to work. You don't have to go to college to figure these things out, no, sir. He said, I learned when I was young that the only true life I have is the life of my brain. But if it's true the only real life I have is the life of my brain, what sense does it make to hand that brain to somebody for 8 hours a day for their particular use on the presumption that at the end of the day they will give it back in an unmutilated condition? Fat chance. So he built that big Montana bedroll, started piping the stem, panhandling, you know. Head full of words and songs. He didn't write songs and poems. He found them and scattered them abroad for people like me to find and put to work again. He was old enough to remember the sway rods under the boxcars, riding the rods. Fry Pan Jack, the two bums. The bum on the rods is hunted down as an enemy of mankind. The other is driven around to his club as feted, wined, and dined. And they who curse the bum on the rods as the essence of all that's bad will greet the other with a winning smile and extend the hand so glad. The bum on the rods is a social flea who gets an occasional bite. The bum on the plush is a social leech, blood-sucking day and night. The bum on the rods has a load so light that his weight we scarcely feel, but it takes the labor of dozens of folks to furnish the other a meal. As long as we sanction the bum on the plush, the other will always be there. But rid ourselves of the bum on the plush and the other will disappear. Then make an intelligent, organized kick. Get rid of the wasted crush. Don't worry about the bum on the rods. Get rid of the bum on the plush.
That was Bum on the Rod. Before that, we had Anarchy. Both of those tunes were from the legendary Utah Phillips, and both of those tunes were from his album, The Past Didn't Go Anywhere. Ani DiFranco was also involved with the production of that album in some manner, but since she does not appear to perform on the album, then she must have been involved with some kind of production work or something. That's it this week. I'll see you next week. You have a good week. Peace.
The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt, nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com and we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day.
And please note that the Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes, or you can now go directly to the Thunderbolt WordPress site, which is at dana98501.wordpress.com.
Thank you very much.